is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Hey, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. That's right. Welcome back. We are back. The hiatus is over and the Lions playoffs, their season is over and the Senior Bowl is over. All the life of a sports writer. I tell you, Keith, it's a hard job, but somebody's got to do it. I'm happy to be back, Keith. Did you enjoy your little hiatus? Did you enjoy your time off?
Well, I enjoyed about two quarters of the NFC Championship game, and after that, it was all downhill.
We don't even need to get into it. Today, we are covering the legend, the worm himself, Dennis Rodman. This is going to be a fun episode. We got a lot to get into. We're mostly going to focus on, obviously, the Pistons side of things, but we'll talk a little Lakers. We'll talk a little Mavericks. We might even talk a little bit of WCW. We'll see how much we can get Keith to talk about wrestling, if we can get him to talk about it at all. But before we get into that, we missed the trade deadline last week, Keith. We were not on the air to talk about it, and let's talk about it now.
Well, we actually missed the initial trade. Since we've been off the air, the Pistons have made, I think, four trades. Actually, five, if you want to count Denwell House for in cap space for a second round pick.
I don't.
So without wasting everybody's time and going into these deals individually, here's essentially what happened in the last month. The Pistons rid themselves of eight players off of their active roster. And if you're doing the math at home, that is more than half the team. Out since our last broadcast are Bojan Bogdanovic, Alec Burks, Kevin Knox, Monte Morris, Joe Harris, Killian Hayes, Isaiah Livers, and Marvin Bagley. Wow, what a list that is. In, on the other hand, are from the Utah Jazz, Simone Fontecchio, from the New York Knicks, Quentin Grimes, Evan Fournier, Malachi Flynn, from the Minnesota Timberwolves, Troy Brown Jr., and Shake Milton, and from the Washington Wizards, Mike Muscala. So that is eight players out, seven players in, and the Pistons have an open roster spot at the moment, which they are currently filling with a 10-day player that they had on their G League team previously. I know who it is. I have issues pronouncing the poor guy's name, so I don't want to butcher it. But he's a stretch four. He got in a little bit last night. I don't know if he's going to be kept around long term, but he does fit the archetype that the Pistons need at the moment.
Well, let's start it off by, you know, the Killian Hayes experiment is over.
Yes.
A first round pick, seventh pick in the draft in the 2020 draft, not too long ago. And they could not find a trade partner for him. I don't even know really how hard they tried. And it just wound up being a straight release.
And the thing is, it's really difficult to find a trade partner when you have a guy that's a fringe NBA player. I think he is an NBA player, but he's not one with tremendous value. And he's one that you've basically advertised to everybody in the league that if you can't find a trade partner, you're just going to release him. So why would any team that actually wants him give up value unless you're that desperate to get Killian Hayes, which nobody is. I do believe that Killian's problems, maybe 50% his own, but the other 50% were the team around him was A, was not very good, and B, was not a very good fit for his talents. And he does have some things that he does very well, but they just were not a good fit in Detroit. And I think it was best for both sides to just part ways. We had our redraft, our 2020 redraft, and Killian Hayes was selected towards the end of our redraft.
Yeah,
I do believe he is an NBA player. I don't think this is the end of his career in the league. I think he maybe is down to his last chance. But I think there's a real NBA player in there. He just needs to go to a functional team, which currently the Detroit Pistons are not.
Well, there's some rumors, and albeit it's just rumors, that the Chicago Bulls have some interest in him. So If he does wind up going to the Bulls, then get ready for that revenge game when he comes to town and magically puts up 30 on the Pistons.
I mean, once a month that jumper is falling, so Pistons could be that unlucky team. Who knows?
It's such a bummer because I just really wanted that to work out. I think we all did,
Yeah.
but it just when it doesn't
The
work, it doesn't work.
look, the writing was on the wall. Drafting Cade Cunningham was fine because every team needs a couple of guards. But once they drafted Jaden Ivey with the fifth pick the very next season, that was kind of the writing on the wall. Spelling the end of Killian Hayes' future in Detroit because you just drafted three guards in a row in the top 10 of the draft. That means you probably weren't thrilled with the first guy you took. It is what it is.
The other guy I really want to talk about is Fontecchio, who is
Fontecchio.
Fontecchio, or as
Yeah.
James is calling him, James Edwards is calling him just Tech, which I'm cool with that, because I wouldn't want to spell that name all the time either. I think the guy you're thinking about is Ryan Arcidiacono or something like that.
Ryan Arcidiacono?
Ryan Arcidiacono, is that the guy you're thinking about? Is that the 10-day guy?
No, he's a veteran. The
Okay.
Pistons cut him simply because they didn't have any use for him.
All
No, the 10-day guy, you know what? I'm just gonna look it up. I feel kind of embarrassed that I don't remember how to pronounce his name offhand. Just give me one second. I'm gonna give it my best shot.
Well, while you do that, I'll talk about Fontecchio. This cat comes
All right,
in and
go ahead.
okay, go ahead. What's the guy's name?
All right, Tosun Awuoma.
Oh, okay. I know him.
Tosun Awuoma, and I want to thank Basketball Reference for helping me out there.
I'm a big fan of him. So he comes in, gets 20 points in his debut game with against the Clippers.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty impressive. Gets 18 last night against Phoenix. A little quiet against the Lakers, but then again, everybody was quiet against the Lakers. That was an ugly, ugly game. But I don't know. I guess I got to be excited about one of these guys, and I think it's him. I think maybe
Well,
there's something there with this guy. I know it's a short sample,
I
but.
think he is going to be the starting small forward, replacing Bojan, or at least for the time being. I know there are some contractual things. They have to keep his number of starts down and his minutes down slightly, in order to keep his cap hold. They're going to bring him back, but the cap hold is the number that's held against your salary cap until you re-sign that player. And his cap hold, I think, right now is, I don't know, something like 2.8. The Pistons will save essentially, they'll have essentially 2.6 million more to spend if Fontecchio's minutes don't meet a certain threshold. So I think towards the end of the season, they'll probably have to have him come off the bench, maybe play him 20 minutes a game. It's not going to be that noticeable. But yeah, I'm really liking Simone Fontecchio. Good 3-and-D player. He's 6'8", but not a very thick 6'8". I think he's exclusively a small forward, not really quick enough to be a guard, not strong enough to be a four. But he has very long arms. He knows how to use length. He knows how to attack closeouts. He finishes around the rim. Excellent spot-up shooter. He's not a guy that's going to get in anybody's way. The only reason that he's going to take a lot of shots is if the other team leaves him open. He's not going to force his own offense. I love everything about the deal for Simone Fontecchio. Quentin Grimes, who I think is eventually going to be the future at the small forward spot, even though he's more of a guard. But he's significantly younger than Fontecchio. I think he is a much better defender. I don't think he's as good of an offensive player. He's also significantly shorter. But that's a guy that's Marcus Sasser's teammate in Houston. Very well known for having a tremendous work ethic, for being an A to A plus defender on any given night. I think that's the guy that the Pistons like most moving forward, even though I think they will bring both of those guys back. And a third guy that I think is criminally undermentioned is Troy Brown Jr., who, like the first two guys, is a plus defender, with good spot up 3-point range. Very good motor, very athletic. Reminds me a little bit of what Sekou Doumbouya was supposed to be. Big wing, good motor, pretty athletic. Came out to the draft way too early. Really struggled in Washington. Had to kind of find his way. But look, he's been in the league 6 years. He's only 24 years old. He was a baby when he was drafted, and he has worked his butt off to bring his jumper to an acceptable level to the point where he can be on the floor. And that's great because I think he has a lot of great qualities on the defensive end. I don't think he's any more than a backup, but I think he's a very good backup. And he has a team option for $4 million next year. That is nothing in the year 2024 for a rotational wing. So I would expect to see him back too. The rest of the players, someone might surprise us down the road. I'm not a big fan of Shake Milton, even though he's a good defender. Offensively, his jumper, I think, is broken. Malachi Flynn, who is a point guard, which is something the Pistons need. The problem is they already have too many guards, and Malachi Flynn is a very poor outside shooter, even though he's very good at everything else, and he's kind of small. Evan Fournier,
I
much
like
like Joe
Evan Fournier.
Harris.
I like this
I'm
one.
sorry.
I like Evan Fournier. I enjoyed
He can't
raising
guard
my
it. There
team.
was a reason he never played in New York, though. He can't guard anyone. Yes, I know he can shoot, but the Pistons just came from having a team that was one of the top 3-point shooting teams in the NBA since January, and they couldn't beat anybody because they couldn't get stops. I don't understand why Fournier even plays, to be honest with you. Maybe he comes back on like a veteran's minimum deal, but that's the only way I'd accept him back because you're just playing the hits all over again if you put him on the court. It's another veteran shooter that can't guard anyone. I think he's an NBA player. I just don't like his fit here. Am I missing anyone? Mike Muscala, yeah, subtle favorite of mine. I think he's a decent backup center, good stretch center, can defend better than people realize. I think maybe his best role might be as a third string center, but I think I like his versatility. He can play the five and the four a little bit. He will never fill up a box score, but he makes the other four guys on the court better because of his spacing and his intelligence and the way he plays the game. So I wouldn't mind having him back next year either, but if they decide to move on from him, I get it. He is kind of old.
Well, we'll see what that looks like, when it comes down to it. I mean, we don't even know what this franchise is going to look like next year. I think we assume that at this point, maybe that everything, nothing's really going to change, but you never know. We'll see. But let's get into what we really came here to talk about. I want to go all the way back to the days of pinball. You remember pinball, Keith? Feel like nobody really plays it anymore. Well,
Yeah, I loved pinball growing up. I still was more of a video game kid. Like I preferred video games at the arcade. But if I were to go to the local pizzeria, my buddy and I, we would waste like a half hour just putting quarters up there trying to beat each other at pinball. I think pinball is a great time. It's the most underrated pastime in the history of electronic games, in my opinion.
Well, Dennis Rodman really enjoyed pinball, and he tend to apparently move his body around so much that his family nicknamed him the Worm, which is something I learned today that he got it playing pinball and not basketball. I thought it was something that he just because he wiggled around so much to get rebounds that he was just, but no, it was because he was wiggling so much at that pinball machine that he's been called the Worm since he was a little kid.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever know the true origins of that. Did you get that off of Wikipedia?
I got it from Dennis himself. He told me this morning on our phone call.
So Wikipedia then.
Yeah,
Okay.
Wikipedia. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if I really buy that. It sounds a little contrived. It could be true. This is just one of those things where I think some of the best nicknames you don't really know where they came from, and this is kind of one of them. I think people are just going to come up with theories and new versions of the truth forever.
Well, anyhow, he grows up, very, very large family. The number of his siblings has been like it people can
His
bring up
father
different
had a lot.
numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, his father had a lot of kids. Dennis himself did not have, I don't think he grew up with a large family. I knew he grew up with a lot of siblings, but not the insane number that his father is reported to, number of kids his father is reported to have.
Right. Well, he definitely had two sisters who were also very good at basketball. One of them actually is a two-time national champion at Louisiana Tech. But Dennis was not that great at basketball. He was actually really small in high school. When he graduated, he was 5'11". And after high school, he went to go get a job at the worst airport in America, the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Once again, the worst airport in America, Keith. And then out of nowhere, an 18, 19-year-old kid has an 8-inch growth spurt.
Yeah, I think kind of the crazy thing is that it's not like he hit his growth spurt late. He was reportedly only 5'6" when he started high school, so he had already grown almost half a foot from his freshman to his senior year in high school. And for most people, that would be close to it, right? And then he grows another, what, 8, 9, 10 inches as an 18, 19, 20-year-old. I mean, that's as many things that are unique about Dennis Rodman, that may be the most unique thing. I'm glad they did the 30 for 30 about him. Not so I can learn these weird things because I already knew them, but so everyone else can realize just, how one of a kind Rodman is and how his life has been. So yeah, suddenly going from a 5'9" basketball player with no future, he grows into a 6'7" human being that, hey, I might actually be good at basketball now. And he still wasn't right away, but obviously being 6'7", having an athletic build and a wiry frame, you're not going to have a hard time finding a college basketball team at some level that wants to have you. And he finds that at Southeastern Oklahoma State, which is essentially a small college. And yeah, he doesn't dominate the way you would expect an NBA player to dominate, a glorified community college, but he averages 26 points, 16 rebounds over a few years. And again, he starts college at like 21, 22 years old where he starts playing. So he's super old as it is, for a college basketball player. And then he comes out for the NBA draft, and not look his numbers, he's a name, but no one really respects him as a draft prospect. And then he goes to the Portsmouth Invitational, and he just blows the whole thing up. It's still going on today, but I remember it being more prominent back then. It was one of the biggest NBA draft showcases at the time, and he was clearly one of the best, if not the best athlete there. And that catches the eyes of Jack McCloskey of the Detroit Pistons.
Well, yeah, you're right. It caught him in the eye, and they wound up actually drafting him in the second round of the 1987 draft. But he's, as you had mentioned before we got on the show, like he wasn't considered the prize pick of this draft, obviously.
No, he was actually the Pistons' second pick. They had actually benefited. They had gotten a higher pick than they normally would have. I think it was the 11th pick in the draft, from a previous deal where they had the rights to swap picks. I think I want to say it was with the Washington Bullets. But in any case, they get John Sally, a very celebrated college player out of Georgia Tech. And John Sally was seen as the prize of the draft, and Rodman was seen more of as the potential kid, the home run swing kid. That he could be pretty good down the road, or he could be nothing. But we already have this John Sally guy, so why not double down and take a chance? And usually that doesn't work out for teams historically, but in Detroit's case, it was the best decision they could have made.
It's interesting, just remembering back on our mock draft, we actually took Dennis Rodman first overall in our in that mock draft.
You took Dennis Rodman first
I
overall.
took and I don't regret it. I still think it's a great pick. I mean,
I
just
think it's a very defensible pick. I'm not, I just want to give credit where credit is due here.
yeah. I took Dennis Rodman in the in our 1987 redraft way back when we started the show, basically.
Like he is very arguably the best player in the 1986 NBA draft, unless you count, Arvydas Sabonis.
I do.
I know. I was thinking the year before that Sabonis was 85. So yeah. All right. So yeah, Rodman's rookie year. He plays, but he is the very last guy in like a 9-10 man rotation. He's getting minutes, but it's like, 14, 15 minutes. Because he's not only behind John Sally, but he's also behind rebounding machine Sidney Green, who was the starting power forward for that season. Did not last that way. He was not the rebounding machine that his nickname suggested. Not a very good defender, but Rodman is, even in the few minutes that Rodman checks in, he is the fan favorite because he's the guy pumping his fist. He is the most enthusiastic guy on the court, no matter what the score is. He is making these spectacular hustle plays where he's diving himself 15 feet into the stands to see if he can save a loose ball, grabbing these impossible rebounds, getting chased down blocks. He is doing all of these very unique things that don't involve, most of them don't involve putting the ball in the basket, but the fans all enjoy them because, well, one, that's kind of the genesis of Bad Boys Detroit Pistons basketball, is the fans, fall in love with the role players. And Rodman was really like the first superstar role player that put his stamp on what being a Detroit Piston meant. And that started, even as a rookie getting spot minutes behind another rookie who was seen as the more important player. I want to make one thing of note about his rookie season. The main reason, in my opinion, is why Sally and Rodman were both drafted is the Pistons had just come off a season, 1986, where they were a tremendous offensive team. And just like the previous 2 years, another team's superstar forward just obliterated them. Dominique Wilkins put 50 on the Pistons in game two. They lost a heartbreaker in game four. The Hawks eliminated them in four games, 3-1. And Dominique Wilkins averaged 34 points in that series, shot just under 50% from the field. He was just a monster. They couldn't do anything with him. And that was the genesis behind McCloskey's obsession with finding defensive-minded forwards in the draft. So flash forward to the following season. The Hawks are I think they have the third best record in the NBA that season. They were the 2 seed in the East. They were heavily favored against the Pistons in the rematch in the second round. And the very first game, Rodman goes for a modest 10 points, 10 rebounds. And you look at that box score and you're thinking, okay, it's not that impressive. Okay, well, 9 of Rodman's rebounds were offensive rebounds. He completely affected the game in just 19 minutes, in a way that completely frustrated the Hawks. And he guarded Dominique Wilkins as a rookie in the playoffs incredibly well. Stuffed him twice in the closing minutes of game one that the Pistons won. And that was the big momentum turn for the series. The Pistons upset the Hawks 4-1 to move on to the conference finals. And that Hawks series, not only was it like the coming out party for the Pistons as legit championship contenders, but it was also the first time that anyone outside of Detroit really got to look at Dennis Rodman and the weird, unique things that he could bring to the table. We would be remiss if we didn't mention, 1987, the conference finals where Rodman plays a little bit. He's somewhat effective, but mostly the series is out of his depth. It's two teams that are clawing each other's eyes out trying for an NBA championship. And it goes to a seventh game. It's a close game, but Bird is by far the best player on either team in that game, 37-9-9. And after the game, Rodman, who didn't guard Bird for most of the game, he didn't play much of the game, but he quips that out of frustration and immaturity that if Bird were black, he wouldn't be seen as a great player, which is utterly ridiculous. And ironically, most of the blame for that comment falls on Isaiah Thomas because he tried to have Rodman's back and turn it into a joke where he agrees with him, but he agrees with him in kind of a laughing tone. And a lot of people in the media that just simply didn't like Isaiah Thomas took it the way that they wanted to take it, and it became a big thing where it was now Isaiah's comment basically instead of Rodman's. And Rodman kind of escapes on that, but I think that stuck with Rodman for about 12 months because he would have his revenge a year later.
That's right. 1988 comes along. He's starting to play more minutes. He's not a starter yet, but he's still a guy who is seen across the league as a defensive stalwart already. In his second year, he's getting defensive player of the year votes. He doesn't win in 88, but he's takes eighth. Obviously the Pistons head to the finals for the first time ever that year as well. So there's a lot going on early in this kid's career.
Yeah, and Rodman, this is the first and only year of his career where he averaged double figure points, despite coming off the bench really for most of it, the season. He averages 11.6 points, 8.7 rebounds. He's still not playing very much, not playing starters minutes, but he's having a very big effect. And what I think a lot of the younger audience doesn't remember about Rodman is he was a very willing scorer his first 2 years in the league. He was very much like Asar Thompson on the fast break, where in the half court, he wasn't much of a threat, but if you got him out in transition, he was a dynamite finisher at 6'7", 6'8", and the most athletic guy on the floor. In many cases, the fastest guy on the floor. He would devastate teams in transition and these little 4 to 5 possession spurts where he would get 8, 9, 10, 12 points just finishing fast breaks. And yeah, like you said, this is where he's starting to get defensive player of the year votes. And really, flashing forward, the Pistons get to a rematch with the Celtics in the conference finals again in 1988. And this time, Rodman is a year older, a year smarter, a year more mature. He is ready for Larry Bird. And he really does a better job on Bird, who averaged 30 points a game that season, a career high. In the conference finals, holds him to 22 points per game, but that doesn't tell the whole story. Bird only shot 35% from the floor and about 28% from three. And there were several moments in several key games where the Celtics had an opportunity to either win the game or get back in the game, and they gave it to Bird isolated against Rodman, and Rodman gave him nothing. The end of game five, which the Pistons won in overtime. But the only reason they got there is because Bird had two chances, two possessions, to win the game in the final minute with the score tied. One time Rodman forced him into an air ball, and the second time he missed, he barely got rim. And that to me, I think, is Rodman's finest series as a Detroit Piston, was the job he did on Larry Bird in the conference finals. They do not advance without the work that he put in to get himself ready for a rematch against one of the greatest small forwards of all time.
Well, much like Asar, phenomenal transition player, great defender. Don't let him take a long shot though. And we're gonna learn that from Dennis in the finals that we don't necessarily want Dennis taking those shots either.
Yeah, so Rodman, again, everyone's assuming Showtime is just going to roll over the bad boys in the finals because they can't keep up with their speed. That was what everyone was saying. They can't keep up with LA's team speed. Dennis Rodman could certainly keep up with it. They used Rodman as this defensive Swiss Army knife where he was guarding James Worthy, and then he was guarding Magic when Dumars was out of the game. And he was guarding everybody but Kareem. And I think he had switched out on Kareem a few times that I can recall. And he frustrated the hell out of the Lakers. And in game seven, Pistons are making this amazing fourth quarter comeback after Isaiah Thomas leaves the game. His sprained ankle just can't go anymore. And they're down 16, and they chop it to 14, then 12, then 10, then 5. Then with a minute left, John Sally gets a big block on James Worthy. They get out in transition. Rodman is on the right wing, And he gets the ball and he pulls up for a freaking 15, 16-foot jumper. He's open, but he had no business taking that shot with the season on the line. And he pulls up and he misses it wide left. It does get rim, but that's all. And that was really the best chance the Pistons had to tie that game up. And Rodman was kind of distraught after that. He had fully admitted that he had no business taking that shot. He just got caught up in the moment. But that was kind of, I don't want to say it was his lowest point as a pit. I don't want to, I think that's too much. Second year player, I understand getting caught up, but yeah, that was definitely his biggest mistake, I think, as a Detroit Piston, was attempting that shot.
Yeah, no, I mean, some of the greatest players of all time had second year playoff appearances where they were banging up some bricks, and Kobe Bryant obviously is the most notable of them. But 1989 rolls around, and it's a much, much better season for Dennis. Now he's makes his first all defensive team. Mark McGwire comes along in a trade for Adrian Dantley, which Rodman kind of pushed him out of town, and we'll talk about that here in a second. But this is going to increase Dennis's minutes to the highest at this point. He's going to play more than he's ever played.
Yeah, so Rodman's still coming off the bench at this point. His minutes are still steadily increasing. He's up to playing half the game, maybe a little more than half the game at this point. And, the national audience that saw him in the conference finals and the finals, we're getting more national appreciation for Dennis Rodman, and it is really showing up during award season. He was very well in the race for most improved. He was third and sixth man of the year voting, and he was third in defensive player of the year. And this is one that kind of broke his heart a little bit, because he and a lot of people thought that he deserved to win defensive player of the year with the dominant season the Pistons had, best record in the league. And I think a couple of factors were held against him. One, because he was still coming off the bench as a reserve, and to the NBA, even though not every year a center was winning it, but you had basically the rim protectors were the ones that were getting all the love year in and year out for defensive player of the year. He was beaten out by Mark Eaton, who didn't even lead the league in blocks, and that was his one real skill. And Hakeem Olajuwon, who needs no further introduction. But I think from that point on, that's when Rodman decided that he wanted to work his way into the starting lineup, simply to win defensive player of the year. One thing Rodman did win, though, he led the NBA in field goal percentage. I'm not sure how he attempted enough shots to qualify, but qualify he did. And that's a very weird statistical fact about Dennis Rodman, that he would lead the NBA in field goal percentage of all things, shot just a hair under 60% for the season.
That's the last thing you would think Dennis Rodman would lead the league in.
Yeah. In the playoffs, his back is starting to act up a little bit. He wasn't as effective in the finals against the Lakers, but he did have one series where he had a major impact. That was the conference finals against the Chicago Bulls. Played barely half the series, averaged just 26 minutes a game, but in those 26 minutes, averaged over 13 rebounds per game. The Pistons struggled offensively. Chicago was a very good defensive team, but every time they missed, Rodman was a threat to get the ball right back and get them extra shots. He was kind of the unsung hero for that entire series, in addition to being a guy that was guarding both Pippen and Jordan, depending on the players that were on the court with him. Once again, he was just a one-of-a-kind type defender. So,
1990
go ahead.
comes rolling around, and this is where he does become a starter. He starts just over 40 games this particular season, makes his first All-Star team, finally gets that Defensive Player of the Year award in a like an incredibly emotional ceremony because you knew he wanted it so badly, and obviously the Pistons are heading back to the finals for the second straight year. So this is big stuff.
Okay, so yeah, the Genesis again for that Genesis for that defensive player of the year was kind of the year before. When he was Rodman was clearly trying to work his way into more minutes, and he was cutting into Adrian Dantley's minutes. And a lot of these games, even though he wasn't starting, he was playing in the fourth quarter instead of Dantley because of the defensive value that he would bring. And they had enough scores anyway with Isaiah and the emergence of Dumars that they didn't really need Dantley anymore as the go-to guy. So, and Dantley couldn't handle it. He couldn't cope with it. So they shipped him out for Aguirre, who was on board with it. And he, even though he was starting, he was okay with Rodman taking his spot at the end of games. So flash forward to 1990, the Pistons are, by their standards as defending champions, they're struggling. They're just 14, 26 and 14. They are not first in their own division. The Chicago Bulls are. So at that point, Dantley finally decides, or excuse me, Chuck Daly finally decides to make the switch, and he subs out, subs Mark Aguirre out of the starting lineup for Dennis Rodman. And the very first game that they play is in Chicago, and the Pistons just go and hammer the hell out of the Bulls. It's not even a close game. And they proceed in Rodman's first 26 games as a full-time starter, the Pistons win 25 of them. They go from 26 and 14 to 51 and 15 in a matter of 2 months. It is just a spark that transforms them back to the dominant team that they were the year before. And again, in the playoffs, his back is starting to act up even worse. And it's weird because this problem never really follows him the rest of his career. It's just during those two championship seasons. He does have one monster game in New York, critical game four in the second round, where he puts up a double-double, gets 14 points, 14 rebounds, has one great play where Ewing goes to the ba Patrick Ewing goes to the basket, Laimbeer holds him up a little bit, and then Rodman soars like from the clouds above Laimbeer's head and swats Ewing's finger roll like 9 feet back into his face. One of it's a really, really impressive block shot. But yeah, I think it is kind of, I want to say sad to a degree that Rodman never really had any great championship moments in the finals in either 89 or 90. In 90 in particular, he actually has to miss game three, which it winds up being one of the best games the Pistons play in that whole postseason, because his back is hurting so much. But they certainly get it done even without him.
Well, 1991, he is the full-time starter now. He's it's his spot. He's going to get his second Defensive Player of the Year award, and has a huge game against the Nuggets. Obviously, the Pistons, and we'll talk about that Nuggets game. But obviously, the Pistons are not, the finals team anymore. They're going to get knocked off by Chicago in a, situation that's eerily similar to the Pistons finally knocking off the Celtics. But tell us about Dennis Rodman's 91 season.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird contrast, right? Because as the Bad Boys are starting to crumble and fall off, Rodman, one of two Pistons along with Dumars, he's starting to hit his prime. He's getting better. And despite the Pistons falling off significantly, Rodman repeats as Defensive Player of the Year. And not only that, he's starting to really hit the boards. Gets double figure rebounds for the first time in his career, as an average 12 and a half. Has this amazing fluke game. And I won't say fluke because I'm pretty sure he could have done it again against the same team, but it was the Paul Westhead Nuggets that just tried to outscore you and didn't really pay any attention to interior play. They just wanted to shoot you off the court. And Rodman gets a career high 34 points to go with 23 rebounds. It is a hilarious stat line for it is by far and away his career best, most points he's ever scored in an NBA game. And he scores most of them easily because it's all transition baskets, which is what Rodman really did the best. Now, yeah, the Pistons do fall off. They only make it really to the conference finals in part because Rodman was so good. against Atlanta in Boston on the glass. But yeah, the entire team falls apart against the Bulls, and the Bad Boys, obviously, we all know they were never the same after that, but it was still a great year for Dennis Rodman.
Not as good as
All
the
right.
year that he's going to have in 1992, though. I mean, 1992 is, I
Yeah,
think,
1992, yes, this is probably Rodman at his athletic peak.
at his very best in the NBA. I mean, all NBA. He makes his first all NBA team. He's all defense, all star, leads the league in rebounds for the first time, which he's going to go on a streak with that. And then has this incredible 34 rebound game against the Pacers, which. Yeah, we definitely need to hear more about.
It's not just the well, first of all, to start with, he was putting up silly rebounding numbers to begin the entire season. About 5 weeks prior to this game, he had 16 points and 32 rebounds in Charlotte against the Hornets. This was simply the record that broke his other record. This was a game towards the end of the season where the Pistons were fighting for playoff positioning. They were up against a scrappy Indiana team that actually had some really good rebounders themselves, most notably a young Dale Davis. And this was a game, I can't remember if it went to overtime or, but it was an extremely close game, and they needed, yeah, it did go to overtime. And they needed every single one of Rodman's 34 rebounds to win that game. This was not a stat padding performance. I think the craziest part about this is he had more offensive rebounds in this game than defensive rebounds. He had 18 offensive rebounds. That is crazy. That is just an incredible 18 rebounds simply on the offensive glass in the 90s when everybody and their brother is going to the glass for rebounds. That is just an insane number. Now, the one thing that Rodman doesn't get is he does not win his third Defensive Player of the Year award despite all of this. He loses it to David Robinson. And we went over this before the show, but it is a very defensible decision to give it to David Robinson. He barely played more than 65 games because he did get hurt at the end of the year, but his averages at the time were silly. He averaged, 4.5 blocks, 2.5 steals. He was by far and away. It was him and he and Rodman, but I think Rodman having it won twice already. I think the media just decided to give this one to David Robinson, and David Robinson certainly deserved it.
Well, now we come to 1993, and this is going to be the final year for Rodman as a Piston, and things just from the jump on this season, things just started going badly. You know, he skips preseason camp, and he gets fined a hefty amount for it. He's kind of feuding with Ron Ronstein, and yeah, just he does lead the league in rebounds again, but yeah, this is a lot of bad things happen. Plus, you know, the Palace of Auburn Hills parking lot incident, and just a lot of things happened this year.
So this is both the best and the worst of Dennis Rodman, all mixed into one season. Dennis Rodman, not the most mature guy. The late growth spurt. Also had a very late maturity spurt. So, flashback to the 92 playoffs. The Pistons lose in 5 games, heartbreaker. And Chuck Daly, who was basically Dennis Rodman's surrogate father, as soon as he came into the NBA, he was the one that cared for Dennis, that brought Dennis along, that made sure Dennis got his opportunities. And there's Chuck Daly and the Pistons go through kind of a messy divorce. Where they don't fire Chuck Daly, but it is very clear that both sides just simply want to move on. Daly's contract was up and he simply left. And Dennis is kind of like this kid whose parents went through a divorce where he's just acting out. Ron Rothstein, who was a previous Daly assistant, was brought in to replace him as head coach. And Rodman treated him, like a kid would treat a stepfather that's trying to replace the old father. He simply did not have any respect for him. He didn't like him because he was the guy that was replacing Chuck Daly, who was a guy that he loved to death. And that was just the bad start for the, it set the tone for the entire season where Rodman, he was missing practices. He got fined for skipping training camp and preseason. Nothing Rothstein could say to him would get through to him. Ryman started this trend of, no, this wasn't the first time he was taking threes, but before it was kind of like a reward. Like he didn't want to make Chuck Daly unhappy for taking three-pointers. It was just, he actually took some decent ones. He shot, prior to this, I think he was a little over 30%, which wasn't terrible at the time. And in 93, it was just, I'm going to take a three-pointer simply to act out for no other reason, because I'm upset, I'm unhappy, and I just feel like being a jerk. It was kind of how it was. Where it, this was kind of where the fans, as much as they loved Dennis Rodman, they were kind of disappointed in him this season. And then the crazy thing is, I've already laid this out for you. He was unhappy, disgruntled, missing practices, skipping training camp. He was just the most disruptive guy, and yet he averaged 18 rebounds a game, led the league by a mile. And he was injured during this season. And despite all of this, the Pistons were 10 games above 500 when he played, 36 and 26. On games where he didn't play, they were 4 and 16. So even at his absolute worst, Dennis Rodman was still capable of massively affecting winning and losing simply by being on the court and doing Dennis Rodman things. That is how massive his impact was, even as a role player on the basketball court, for a guy that didn't even average 10 points a game. I am fascinated by this entire season for that reason alone.
Well, you know, that is going to be the end of Dennis Rodman as a Piston. He's going to get traded to the Spurs in the before the 1994 season, and the deal that brought Keith's favorite player, Sean Elliott, to Detroit. There was a lot of trouble in San Antonio, but you know, I guess this is where kind of the Dennis Rodman that we all know as the pop culture icon starts to form, where he's dyeing his hair for the first time and some of the off court stuff. I think this is where he dated Madonna, if I'm not mistaken, was during these years, which Madonna at Spurs games is just a weird thing to think about, but doesn't work out in San Antonio, and he eventually gets moved out of there.
Yeah, so Rodman, he starts out dyeing his hair blonde because that was the movie Demolition Man came out.
Great movie.
Yeah, that summer. I agree with you, actually. It is a great movie. Dumb, but great in a dumb way. So it started Wesley Snipes as this bad guy with bleach blonde hair. So Rodman shows up to camp with bleach blonde hair, and it kind of takes off because back then not a lot of guys were dyeing their hair, and he really stood out, and Rodman stands out to begin with. So it was getting him a lot of attention, so he kept doing it. So over the first year, it was, I think he was just blonde the entire year. And then the second year, he started mixing in different colors, having designs. It was kind of a fun thing. But his time in San Antonio, and you did not need to be a genius to see that this was not going to work out. Just an ultra-conservative community like San Antonio, the clean-cut, uptight superstar in David Robinson. And Rodman is just a big ball of chaos. And you knew he wasn't going to fit as a Spur. And he didn't even try to blend in with them, even though they tried to ingratiate themselves to him. It was just, they tried to make it work, but he had two different head coaches, fought with both of them, and by the playoffs, both seasons, he kind of burned out. Gets himself suspended in the first round, his first season in San Antonio, for a ridiculous flagrant clothesline against John Stockton. The Spurs lose in the first round to Utah. And then the second round, John Lucas, the previous head coach, is replaced by Bob Hill. He doesn't try to get through to Rodman as much as Lucas did. He tries more of a hard-nosed approach, and that doesn't work either. He winds up benching him for several games, and that just drives Rodman further and further away. His last season in San Antonio, at least to me, is remembered for him with his sitting on the bench with his shoes off during the conference finals, and he's just chasing rebounds at this point. He's not really playing very good defense, and it cost the Spurs the first game against the Rockets at home. They're still leading by a point with time running out, and Robert Ori, or excuse me, Dennis Rodman is designed to guard Robert Ori of all people, and he just, if you watch the end of the game, he is standing right in front of the rim, just waiting for the rebound, and he just lets Rodman shoot, or lets Ori shoot. Like, Ori gets the ball at the top of the key, and he's hesitating because he's looking, where's the help coming from it? And no one's coming. And it's just Rodman standing there in front of the rim, staring at him. So Ori takes two practice dribbles and drains an 18-footer. I mean, this is the last basket of a conference finals game. And Rodman is just so detached. I don't know if he was purposely trying to let Ori score or he just didn't care. But it was one of those, as soon as that ball went, I don't know how they played him the rest of the series, to be honest with you. Like, Rodman had a decent series, but it was just, he was so detached from the concept of winning at that point. You knew they weren't going to be able to bring him back, first off, but I don't know how they were able to have him on the court. I guess simply because he was just so damn good that they figured if they took him off, their chances of beating the Rockets were zero, which they lost anyway.
Well, then he's gonna head to Chicago, and Phil Jackson, I think does a good job of sort of calming him down as much as you can. Obviously, there's the whole Vegas situation, and there's he takes off and decides to go to the WCW and join the NWO with Hulk Hogan, and which, hey, look, him and Hulk Hogan versus Diamond Dallas Page and Karl Malone is still a pretty fun little thing to see. I know Keith's not a big wrestling fan, but if you're going to watch one match, Keith, you should watch that one, because of, the basketball thing, obviously. But he's going to win three titles in Chicago, and as you mentioned off the air, he's a huge part of that first one against Seattle, and doesn't really get a ton of credit for it.
Okay, so and this is kind of nuts. So Rodman goes to the Bulls. The trade package that the Bulls send to San Antonio is Will Perdue, which is that shows just how toxic everyone looked at Dennis Rodman at the time. But he goes to the Bulls and under, like you said, Phil Jackson and also Michael Jordan, everyone kept a close eye on him. But he responded well to that structure, and he's back to being kind of the Dennis of old, where he's still Dennis, but he's playing winning basketball again. And the Bulls go from a team that was, bounced out of the second round by the Orlando Magic to a team that was one of the greatest teams of all time in '96, 72 wins to 10 losses. The most still to this day, the most wins ever by a team in the regular season that actually went on to win the championship. And
Sorry, you don't count.
no, they don't. You got to finish the job. All right. So, but the thing is that that Bulls team still wasn't incredibly deep. And it winning 72 games took a lot out of them. And as the playoffs went on, you could see them starting to run out of gas just a little bit. They were still dominant. But they weren't as dominant as they were during the season. And in the finals, they meet the Seattle Supersonics, were probably the team best equipped to defend the Bulls during any of their championship seasons. They were a matchup problem for the Bulls just about everywhere. And everyone remembers the Bulls won the series 4-2. They were up 3-0. Let the Sonics win a couple and then finished them off in game six, but that's not really how the series went. The Sonics soundly outshot the Bulls. They played more efficient basketball than the Bulls all six games. Shot much better from the field, shot much better from three. The only reason that the Bulls were able to finish off the Sonics was because Dennis Rodman collected 41 offensive rebounds in six games. Let me repeat that. Six games, 41 offensive rebounds. The Bulls absolutely
It's
crushed
insane.
Seattle on the offensive glass. Even though the Bulls and even Michael Jordan were struggling to find good shots. He kept getting the ball back for them. The Bulls, over the course of the series, attempted 56 more shots than the Sonics did. That was over 6 games. They had 56 extra shots at the rim. That was the difference in the entire series. And Rodman, it's hard to say, at least for me, that Michael Jordan doesn't deserve a Finals MVP. But I think Dennis Rodman absolutely should have been considered for the MVP of that final series, because he was the one thing that Seattle couldn't handle. They defended Michael Jordan very well. They defended Pippen and Kukoc very well. They had no answer to keep Rodman off of the offensive glass. They couldn't do it. And to me, at least, that just for me, that is the most impressive playoff series that Rodman ever played in his career.
Well, he's going to head to the Lakers after this, and he's going to be there for the 1999 season. And I think that if he just would have been there in 2000, like this would have worked out so much better. Maybe I'm wrong.
You're right to an extent. Kurt Rambis being the coach, being a guy that Rodman played against previously, certainly didn't help. That 99 Lakers team was dysfunctional before he got there. After he got there, they were even worse. Leaving the Bulls were really the only team in the entire league that could have corralled him and cajoled him into being a winning basketball player. No other team in the league had a shot. And yeah, Phil Jackson may have gotten through to him a little bit, but it wasn't just Phil Jackson. It was Michael Jordan. It was an entire team effort by the Bulls to keep Rodman in line. And Rodman was interested in being part of a dynasty. So all of the winning only made him want to buy in more. The Lakers at that time, even in 2000, they weren't a championship team yet. They were in the process of winning one, but there was no one in that locker room, even Shaq, that had the kind of respect that Jordan did, that Dennis Rodman would actually listen to them. So I don't know if it really mattered who the coach was. It just made it worse.
Well, some of our younger audience members may not know this, or just probably don't remember it. But in 2000, for 12 games, Dennis Rodman played with Dirk Nowitzki and the Dallas Mavericks. And it's so rare that there's only like two basketball cards of it in existence, and I don't have either one of them yet, and I need that. But it's insane. He's living in Mark Cuban's basement, and suddenly here he is playing for the Mavericks, 12 games. But Keith, as you mentioned before, somehow still manages to average 14 rebounds a game.
At 38, not really engaged at all, not really caring, living out of Mark Cuban's basement, still manages to average over 14 rebounds per game in spot minutes playing for the Dallas Mavericks. you just could not keep him off the glass. Was not a winning basketball player at any point during that season. They cut him almost as quickly as they got him. But it is still funny to me that even Dennis Rodman, his absolute worst, was still a guy that was the best rebounder on the floor, because he was so gifted at it.
He just kind of had rebounding broken down to a science, and he explains that on the Bad Boys 30 for 30, and it's really interesting. But after that, he's going to head to the ABA. No, not that ABA. Mexico, England, and then he's going to try his hand at acting. I don't know if you've seen the Dennis Rodman, Jean-Claude Van Damme helmed double team movie, but go ahead and skip that if.
Bad.
Yeah, skip that. He's gonna try some acting, and he's doing a bunch of other things, and we're just not gonna talk about today. But I do want to talk about a couple things. First thing, there is gonna be a movie being made about that 48 hours in Vegas where nobody could find Dennis Rodman. and a bunch of crazy stuff happened. Jonathan Majors was supposed to play Dennis Rodman in that movie, but with Majors' latest issues, they've dropped him from that. So they're obviously still very early into the whole production of this, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing that movie whenever that finally comes out. But speaking of movies, Bad as I Want to Be, a TV movie that came out 1998. Keith and I both agree that this is 10 times better than the Michael Jordan TV movie that came out, which is just insanely bad and maybe one of the worst movies ever made. But this movie's on YouTube, Keith. And I'm kind of thinking that we should probably do an episode on it at some point.
You know what? As painful as that sounds, I think we might actually get a good episode out of it. I have not seen it since it came out, but I did see it and I still remember it pretty vividly. So it reminds me a little bit of, remember the movie The Blind Side?
Yeah, I do.
Yep. It wouldn't shock me if whoever wrote the movie The Blind Side kind of watched this movie and was inspired by it, because I recall a lot of similarities.
Well, we'll
This movie takes a lot of liberties with actual, things that happened.
be sure to put this on the schedule then. We're definitely gonna do this. It's on YouTube. Just type in "Bad as I Want to Be" Dennis Rodman on YouTube. You can watch it, and then eventually we'll do an episode on it. We'll talk about it. We'll give you guys a heads up before we do that episode so you can watch the movie with us. But yeah, I mean that's Dennis Rodman's career. He's a Hall of Famer now. His number 10 was retired by the Pistons. I think maybe the Bulls retired his 91. I'm not sure. But what's the legacy? For me, it's obvious. He's one of the greatest defensive players of all time. The best rebounder to ever play this game. I know there's Wilt, I know there's Bill, but for me, the NBA starts in the 80s, and then I think nobody's been as good as him since then.
Yeah, the legacy for Dennis Rodman to me is every time I watch Asar Thompson play. I am not comparing them directly, even though Asar's the way he plays the game, it reminds me a little bit of Rodman, but that's not the point here. The point is that Rodman was the very first guy, he and Scottie Pippen, the very first forwards, rangy, 6'7", 6'8", extremely mobile, very versatile, could guard any of four different positions on the floor. Rodman was in the league a year ahead of Pippen, kind of started doing it before him, but they were both, to me, those were the forerunners of all of the rangy defensive wings that we see today. The guys that dominate the league defensively, like the Kawhi Leonards. That's to me is Dennis Rodman's legacy, that he basically created a new archetype that the NBA is now thriving with today.
And can he play today? I think with the Ausar Thompson comparison, I think it's pretty obvious that he could. I think he'd be the best defender in the league right
Rodman was a better shooter than Asar Thompson is,
now. Oh boy.
as sad as that is to say. And
Oh
Asar
boy.
Thompson was the, well, look, his twin isn't much better, but fifth pick in the draft, and everyone knew he couldn't shoot, but they drafted him because of all of the things that he could do. And that's, I think, a parallel to Dennis Rodman, who, even though he averaged a ton of points at a small, at the NAIA level, or no one really projected him as a scorer in the NBA, and he wasn't, but he was very undervalued because of all of the things that he could do, are today are valued. He was the first one to really make us look at it that way. Before Rodman, you had to score points to be seen as a very valuable player. And, Rodman kind of turned that on its head. Scoring still matters today. Everybody scores points, but the concept of the defensive wing is very much ingrained in the NBA in 2024. So yeah, could Rodman play today? Yes. Would he have had to evolve or change his game a little bit? Yeah, he really would have. But there are too many similar athletes to him today that I wouldn't be able to say that no, he couldn't No chance. No, he could definitely play today.
Well, that is going to do it for this Dennis Rodman episode. This was a lot of fun. I certainly enjoyed this one. I don't know what we're going to be doing next week. We'll have to certainly have a discussion about that, but we will see you guys next week. Thanks for bearing with us on the hiatus. Yep. I just became the busiest person in the whole world during a playoff run that was just incredibly magical until it wasn't. And then it was immediately sent out of town the very next day. So here I am. I'm in town, at least for until the combine. I'll be out of town for that too, but we'll figure something out and get you guys an episode. But thank you for bearing with us on that, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.